Steve Chaney, Chairman, or I'm sorry, CEO of the American Security Project. Just a little bit of background on me. I'm a retired Marine artillery officer, and in contrast to General Caswell, I was an aviator. I'm here to lend dignity to what would otherwise be a vulgar brawl. So let me just lay a little bit of ground rules out up front. I'm going to just talk for a second about why we're here, and we'll have each of our guests speak for somewhere between 5 and 10 minutes, and then if we have some allotted time at the end, we'll do a Q&A. This indeed is a special day for us, and we're going to talk about American competitiveness. And it's been a plank topic for the American Security Project for a number of years. What has spurred this occasion was last fall, we put out a product called American Competitiveness, a white paper written by August Cole. And August is right over here, formerly worked for Wall Street Journal out of Boston for us. And it talked about how America is slipping competitively. World Economic Forum used to rank us number one, I think in 2007, we dropped to seventh this past year. And there's a slew of other categories you can look at to see how we dropped competitively worldwide. Where the American Security Project came from, this issue was from the security perspective. And we addressed that in our white paper. We've got a couple of folks on the panel who will talk about that at some length. But coincidentally to this, Mr. Alex Boyle, and Alex sitting right over here, who's a Harvard Business School alum, read our report and asked us if we'd read the Harvard's Business School survey on competitiveness, the first one they did in 2011, the second in 2012, and we had not. So we put the two together, and when we compared them side by side, there's an amazing similarity between the conclusions that were drawn between the two. So we thought it was a powerful argument when you take the national security perspective on American competitiveness and team it up with the business side of the house, that you've got a pretty good force here to come up, particularly on Capitol Hill, and talk to our legislators and the staff members about how we can improve our competitiveness in the United States. And that's why we're here today. We've got a very distinguished panel here. On my far left is Lieutenant General John Kasteloff, retired Marine three-star, used to run plans, policies, and operations for the Marine Corps. Dr. Jan Rifkin from the Harvard Business School. Norm Augustine, former chairman and CEO of Lockheed Martin, and Daniel Disparte, who's president of the Harvard Business School Club here in Washington, D.C., and an alum of that distinguished organization. We are going to have a little shift here at 1:30. We are expecting Mike Porter here. He's out with the House Ways and Means Committee at the moment, and Mr. Augustine has to depart, so we're going to do a little hot bunking here at about 1:30, just so you recognize what's going on there. With that, I'm going to turn it over first to Dr. Rifkin and let him talk about Harvard's perspective on American competitiveness.
Great. Thanks, Steve. And thanks to ASB for the great work you do and for partnering with HBS today to talk about U.S. competitiveness. So the HBS project on U.S. competitiveness started about 2 years ago. It's involved about 20 faculty, including my co-chair, Mike Porter, who will join us once he frees himself from lunch with the Ways and Means Committee. The project was really motivated by two ideas. The first idea was that the issues we see with the American economy today, with stagnant wages, with record low levels of private sector job creation, with jobless recoveries, high unemployment even while we've got persistent job openings, low labor force participation, these problems are not just the hangover of the Great Recession, but reflect a structural challenge of U.S. competitiveness, which has been a generation in the making. The second idea was that there was a role for business leaders to address this challenge. A lot of the public discourse about U.S. competitiveness focuses on the question, what should the government do? Incredibly important question. Our focus has really been, what should business leaders do? What are their roles and responsibilities? And our typical audience is instead of business leaders, and we have been out to business leaders trying to ask more of them to address issues of U.S. competitiveness. But inevitably, in the process of thinking about the question for business leaders, we've also developed a perspective on what the government priorities, particularly federal government priorities, should be. We started to share that perspective as it developed with first business leaders across the political spectrum, then with policymakers, with national security experts, with civic leaders. And to be honest, we expected that as we did so, we would encounter deep divides, disagreements, but we found something that was far, far stranger. We found that across the political spectrum,
there was actually fundamental agreement on some things that should get done. We were kind of amazed by that, so we put it out and we asked 7,000 of our alumni in a survey and 1,000 members of the general public across the political spectrum, do you support these policies or not? And we came back again with a remarkable consensus on some of the things that need to get done in Washington. Now, I hope you're dying to know what those things are, but I'll come back to that in just a second. Because I think to describe what I'm going to identify as these policies and make them seem more like a strategy than just a laundry list, I need to set a little context. I'll start the context by saying what we believe competitiveness is. The term is often misused. The faculty who fought over this is only faculty who fight. And overall, we've come to the judgment that the U.S. is competitive to the extent that firms here can do two key things. First, succeed in global marketplaces. But second, lift the living standards of the average American. And the second part of that definition is incredibly important and often lost in the discourse. People will say things like, boy, the U.S. would be more competitive if only wages here were lower, right? And that would make it easier for firms to compete. It would not lift living standards. It would not be a sign that we're competitive. It's a sign, in fact, that we're not competitive and we need to take a national pay cut in order to sell our goods abroad. Now, the only way to do both of those things, succeed in the global marketplace and also lift living standards, is to be highly productive. And the key to productivity in a country is to have what we call a very rich commons. The commons is a set of shared resources that every company draws from being productive. Every company needs a pool of skilled labor, an educated populace, strong infrastructure, scientific institutions that produce basic R&D, rule of law, rules of the road that send resources to their most productive users, right? And historically in the U.S., I believe that government and business cooperated to build a very strong commons, most productive the world has ever seen. But in the last couple decades, we've essentially colluded to let the commons get run down. And the theme of the kind of policies that seem to get consensus across the political spectrum, the ones that we would identify as priorities, all have the theme of trying to replenish the commons, which has gotten run down. So the kinds of policies that I'll throw out there, and I'll see how the rest of the panel comes about these, would be things like the following. Strong investment in infrastructure in America. I think it's absolutely crazy that in a time when interest rates are as low as we will ever see them, when there is unemployment in the construction sector, and when we've got crumbling infrastructure, that we can't be more aggressive about investing in infrastructure for the future. High-skill immigration. Equally crazy is the notion that we bring to this country the best and brightest from around the world. We train them well. They want to stay here, create lives, create jobs. And we tell them, no, we've got to go home. I'm glad to see in Washington. We seem to be making some headway on that. Policies like corporate tax reform. We currently have the worst of all worlds. We've got a high statutory rate, a narrow base, a low effective rate. We've got things that discourage companies from bringing profits back from overseas to invest here. And essentially, lots of incentives for firms to invest in accountants and lawyers rather than more productive uses. And I say that with apologies to my friends who are accountants and lawyers. I'd add to the list things about regulation, things about getting our federal budget on a sustainable path, things about tackling places in the international trading system where we're putting ourselves at a systematic disadvantage, things about tapping the energy resources that our country is currently blessed with, but doing so in a responsible environmental way. But it gets to be a relatively long list. But the theme I'd say that goes throughout it is that we need to have a strategy for replenishing the commons, which allows the country to be productive and allows both our companies and our citizens to thrive.
Well said, great comments. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Norm Augustine, former Lockheed Martin.
Okay, well, thank you. And it is my privilege to serve on the Board of the American Security Project. And as I've been interested in this topic for a long time, I find myself in virtually total agreement with the results that the Harvard Business School study has produced, several of their studies in this area. Let me say that to me, competitiveness is an acronym for jobs, and not just an acronym for jobs for the elite, but acronym for the jobs for the middle class in this country, and my comments will relate to that. My perspective on competitiveness traces back through my background. I spent a decade in government, all in the Defense Department, finally as Undersecretary and Acting Secretary of the Army. I spent 4 decades in business and less than a decade in higher education. And in doing that, I've come to the strong conclusion that if we have a weak economy, we won't be able to afford a strong military. The Soviet Union is a canonical example. If we have a weak economy, we will no longer have clout in the geopolitical world. Other nations will ignore us. And thirdly, if we have a weak economy, the quality of life of our citizens will decline. And not those at the top of the ladder so much, but the ones further down the economic ladder. I became concerned at the end of the Cold War that some 2 billion new would-be capitalist workers were going to enter the job market almost overnight in the global job market. And that many of these folks were willing to work for a fraction of the money that we're accustomed to receiving in this country. Many of them are highly motivated. They're increasingly well-educated. And it changed the job market of the world in a major way. I had the occasion to work on the Hart-Grumman study after that, which was into national security. The question was, what do we need to do to make national security stronger? And it was a bipartisan group established by the Congress. And the unanimous result, there were two findings. One was, this was before 9/11. One was that Americans are likely to die by the tens of thousands on U.S. soil due to the actions of terrorists. The second conclusion was that the greatest thing that we could do to help national security would be to improve our K-12 education system and to properly manage new knowledge, namely scientific research. That was from a group that was addressing national security. You may be familiar with the Gathering Storm report that was requested by the Congress a couple of years ago. The National Academies conducted it, had 20 members, presidents of universities, CEOs, several Nobel laureates, and so on. The unanimous conclusion was that America is losing its place in competitiveness, read jobs, and that this was an area we once dominated. As you just heard, it was mentioned that we dropped from 1st to 7th place by those who rank us globally in competitiveness. This is not due to ups and downs in the economy. Those are going to happen. They have happened. They'll continue to happen. It is due to a systemic problem that the nation faces. Problems in K-12 education, problems in tax policy, problems in patent policy, underinvestment in research, federal debt, excessive regulation, and I can go on. These are not things that are due to changes in the economy such as we've seen in the last few years. The situation today is worse by and large than it was, as I've traced through these various other studies that have been done. And I think there are several reasons why the situation is worse. One is that others are getting a lot better. That's perhaps the major reason. It's not so much that we're getting a lot worse. Others are getting better education systems, better factories, higher technology, and so on. Another reason is, of course, the impact of the national debt, which is a huge burden. I don't need to say that in this building. Another is that, unlike any time until the last couple of years in my lifetime, the major competitive asset America has, which is its higher education system, is today highly threatened. That's new. The higher education system, public higher education system, today has a financial model that probably doesn't work in today's world. That brings me to the role of math and science in this competitive world. There have been a number of studies, one of which got a Nobel Prize, that showed that between 50% and 85% of the growth of GDP can be traced to advancements in science and technology. My own economic analysis shows that every time you add a point to the GDP, you get 1 million jobs in this country. And you may say, what's an engineer have doing economic analyses? I would just remind you that I really am a rocket scientist. The country, by and large, has been able to stay competitive as we have in high-tech areas because of foreign-born individuals. In my field, Wernher von Braun, today, two-thirds of the people who get PhDs in engineering from our universities are foreign-born. Today, we make it very hard for them to come here, but we make it very hard for them to stay here. And more, they're saying they want to go home when they get their degree. And more, the very, very best of them are no longer coming here. They're staying in their own universities, particularly in India, China, and places like that. In terms of production of engineers at Sinus, but I'll use engineers as an example since I are one, there's been a study by the National Academies, NSF, of 93 countries asking the question of what percent of the baccalaureate degrees go to people in engineering. The United States ranked 79th of those 93 nations. The country closest to it, to us in both sides, and engineering happens to be Mozambique. We've been cutting research in this country. We still are. At a time, other nations are increasing their research. I just came back from Germany, which is about to take on another increase in research. Sad to say, U.S. companies have found a solution. And that solution is, if you can't find engineers and scientists here, if you can't deal with the tax laws here, if the regulations are too oppressive, and most of the market growth is not in the United States, what do you do? The answer is you go where the action is, which is not here. And more, we've seen companies take their factories and move them out of here. 40,000 factories closed in this country in the last decade. But now what's happening is they're moving their research labs. They're moving their engineering centers, the logistics centers. And once those go, they're very, very hard to get back. Steve Jobs told the president that the reason that his company 700,000 people abroad because he couldn't find 30,000 engineers in this country. As we sit here, Microsoft is building a major software development facility across the border in Canada because our immigration laws are such that they can't bring right people from abroad into this country. There aren't enough people in science and technology in this country to fill their job needs. The Harvard Business School and the ASP have proposed some recommendations. I sliced them a little differently. Let me kind of run through my list. Number one on my list is to get teachers who are qualified to teach the subjects they teach in K through 12. That may not sound very profound to you, but if we did, it would be quite an anomaly in today's system. Secondly, we need to invest a great deal more money in basic research. Basic research is the engine that drives business in this country. And basic research today is principally done in our universities. It's funding our universities, and for reasons that take too long to go into at this point, that's going to have to be more and more responsibility of the federal government to fund that research. Next, we need to save our state research universities that today are being privatized by their states through lack of investment. But those universities have no endowment, such as our great private universities do. Tax policy, you've heard about, I'll add no more. And finally, encouraging really bright foreign-born individuals in fields that can add to America's economy, create jobs for Americans. They don't take jobs from Americans, they create them for Americans to allow them to come here and to stay here. Over half the companies in Silicon Valley were started by at least one founder who was not American born. Let me just conclude by saying that I've sat in my life, I'm getting long in years, I guess, because I've sat in over 500 board meetings of Fortune 100 companies. And in many of those meetings, we were debating, do we build a new plant or whatever in the United States, or do we build it in XYZ country? And increasingly, XYZ is winning. And it's not that these boardrooms aren't filled with loyal Americans, they are. But the law of this country says that you also have to look out for your shareholders. And today, looking out for your shareholders in this country often means going abroad. And if that happens, Americans will suffer. CEOs will still get their bonuses. They'll just get it for business done abroad. The U.S. shareholders will get their dividends for business done abroad. But the American person who's seeking a job won't be able to find one in this country. They'll have to move abroad to find a job. The thing that's really at stake here, in my mind, is the American dream. I've lived the American dream. My wife is an immigrant. She lived the American dream. And that's what we're talking about. And that's why a retired guy like me is spending his time talking about competitiveness, jobs, education, tax policy, and so on. And I thank you so much for listening and for what you're doing.
Norm, thanks for those uplifting comments. Let me turn it over to General Castelaw to get a national security perspective on it.
Well, thank you very much. You know, it's a real honor for me to be up here overhanging with this group. You know, most of the people up here, you know, either graduated or teach at Harvard and then went to Princeton, the Naval Academy, or something like that. I got my master's from the American Military University, Box 506, Charlestown, West Virginia. In addition to that, the Marine Corps never sent me to any institution that required any intellectual capability. So it's a real honor to be here to do that. I went to NATO Defense College, which is supposed to be your top level course, and it had two types of reading, suggested and recommended, and no test. But it had a great happy hour. You know, I was in the Marine Corps for 36 years. When I graduated from the University of Tennessee at Martin with a degree in agriculture, I told my wife and said, honey, three more years, we're back on the farm. And it took 36 years to get back to that farm. I was a fifth generation farmer from a little county in West Tennessee. And going into the military is something that we do. The 15% of the United States that are the rural population across the country make up 40% of those who serve in the military. So it's the type of environment, the feeling for service to the community and to the nation. But as I went through that 36 years, I missed a generation. And so when I retired from the Marine Corps, transitioned to civilian life, I went back to Crockett County, and I looked at what was going on there at that time. And what I saw was this. All the small businesses had pretty much melted away. You know, when I left, we had a Ford dealership, we had a Chevy dealership, and the county wasn't but about, you know, 12, 13,000 people. We don't even yet have a stoplight, a traffic light in the county. We had three or four tractor dealerships. We had, you know, Brown Shoe, and we had a very interesting company we called the Corset Factory, where they made women's undergarments, and it was one of the economic pillars of the community. And when you went to Little League games where I played and all, you know, you had a Little League uniform, and on the back of it, you know, sponsored by the Corset Factory, which was pretty interesting. I had never played for that team. And so the education also, you know, you could tell the difference in education. My mother was the first one in both sides of my family that ever went to college, the first one to ever get a degree. And so even at that, we had that, personal interaction in the schools and so forth that was so important to build. And, you know, out of that little community, we had a couple ambassadors, Assistant Secretary of Defense, and a number of others who went on to become leaders in business and in community and in politics. And what I saw when I left was a sense of community, a sense of belonging, of participation. And when I came back, that was not there. And what was even more disconcerting was the average income for the people in that county was less than it was when I left, because all those little industries had lit up and so forth. The train that came through the county the track had been taken up, and you could see the infrastructure was continuing to deteriorate. So as I became a civilian and started also to be concerned, continued to be concerned with national security, I started to look at, okay, just what makes up the strength of America? What makes us the power that we have in the world? It's certainly not military power alone. That is just one element. You know, we've been at war for 12 years. I'll always remember being on a dam in western Iraq, Haditha Dam, looking down in the Euphrates River and watching a column of Marines come back to the secure area. And then just as they were coming around a corner, I saw one of the biggest explosions I've ever seen in my life when an IED went off. And, you know, for all those years, we've been sending these veterans to war and then coming back. And what have they been coming back to? They haven't been coming back to the jobs that they deserve for their sacrifice. They haven't been coming back to the jobs that their community needs to thrive. And so what we need to do for our security is that we need to look at how can we create an environment that supports the small businesses? How can we bring them back? How can we provide those jobs for those people who want to live and work in the communities and contribute and strengthen the fiber? The fiber, which is the basic strength of the United States. We also need to look at how we do energy. You know, when I was in college, I had a 69 Chevelle 396 Super Sport Canary Yellow with a black vinyl top. I had a bunch of girls. But I also filled up at 22 cents a gallon. And did get me all that far out of the car. That 396 got 6 miles to the gallon, but you know, I was fast getting there. We need to have a reasonable, practical energy policy that takes advantage of what we have in a balanced way and moves us down the road to where we need to be with our concerns for the environment and what's going on. We need to be conserving of our natural resources, the water, and the land, and the trees, and all that we have. All of this contributes to a feeling of community and involvement and strength that should underlie our great nation. And I think the key to this, and the other things have been mentioned, so I won't go through that again, is that we need to have an integrated approach. You know, when you go in the military, the first thing you learn is a 5-paragraph order, situation, mission, execution, logistics, admin, and law. And you go through it, and that way you get a plan that has some analysis behind it and gives you a actionable way of getting to where you want. And so that's what we need to do, is we need to bring into all those elements of our national power, military, economic, diplomatic, our educational resources, all those things that you mentioned here, and put it together in an integrated way that gets us from where we are now to where we need to be to continue our role in the world. And again, it's great to be here with these smart people. And you know, I've got a regional dialectical speech impediment. I know some of you out there can't understand Southern drawl, so after it's over with, I'll write it out for you.
If you think for a second that General Kasteloff, good old boy from down on the farm, he has lulled you into a false sense of security. I see Dr. Porter has joined us. Mike, let me introduce Dante and let him give his talk, and then I'll bring up to speed about where
Thanks.
We stand here.
Terrific.
Dante.
Sure, thanks. First of all, I'm absolutely delighted to be here, and thanks for everyone who's attending. I think that from my vantage point, I can put on both hats, both the perspective of competitiveness, which I subscribe to Norm's definition that it equals jobs. This is not a lofty term. This is not an academic term. This is a real one. And it translates into the real economy by middle class jobs that are functional, that have a career trajectory where wages will grow with it. Work, BC is very good at creating work. Build a road to nowhere. There's a whole host of ways of creating work in the short term. But competitiveness as it is being defined by HVS and ASP truly is something that is transformational and something that the nation is clearly lagging on, but I would subscribe to not nearly as grim a view as I think that we've heard from so far. And I would argue that the fact that you have ASP representing the national security lens and Harvard Business School and really representing the voice of 10,000 of our alumni network, and myself, I speak on behalf of the alumni network here in DC, Maryland, and Virginia, where we have nearly 3,000 alumni. I would say that the fact that this conversation is happening is the opening salvo of what is hopefully a very concerted effort to put tangible quick wins on the agenda and not get lost in the fact that this is truly a generational problem. As Dr. Rifkin highlighted, the decline in competitiveness is something that precedes the Great Recession, the economic crisis. Therefore, there are indeed very real, very structural challenges that are out there. But I would also offer that this is not a zero-sum game. America winning the conflict against competitiveness doesn't have to come at the expense of any other country. It really is genuinely an all-ships-rising proposition. And, you know, many of the points that have been highlighted so far, I think, are the ones that I would echo myself, that fixing the tax code, the corporate tax code specifically, would repatriate, you know, right now there's around $1.7 trillion in profits that are being kept in store abroad. Multinationals, the very ones that Dr. Porter and Rifkin have educated over many years, often fly flags of convenience. And those flags of convenience, much like, you know, in the shipping industry, allow them to dock in ports where it's convenient to, you know, create work, labor, access to markets, and so on and so forth. But this nation doesn't have to necessarily be the one that is in decline, and it doesn't have to come at the expense of any other country that's out there. And I think that, frankly, this conversation, what these two separate reports and the two lenses that they represent, bring, you know, in my view, a lot of sort of opportunities that are very tangible for change, especially here in D.C. But I don't want to stand in the way of Dr. Porter's remarks. I'm sure everybody in the room wants to hear them. So that's kind of my view and a few words.
Dante, thank you. Dr. Porter, we're delighted you can make it. He comes from the House Ways and Means Committee, making best use of our assets, of course. We had Norm Augustine in your seat before we hot bumped, so you could get in here. He gave an interesting business perspective on competitiveness and gave some great anecdotal stories. General Kaskalov down on the farm told us about rural Tennessee and the impact it's had there. And then he pitched the national security side of the house, certainly after his 36 years as a Marine. Jan, of course, addressed the Harvard Business School survey and offers a lot of ways we can improve our competitiveness. But we're very anxious to hear your views on it, and we're so pleased that you're here. The floor is yours.
Well, I'm sorry to be late. I had an opportunity to speak to the Republican members of the House Ways and Means Committee. They're in a position of enormous influence, and frankly, it was a very hopeful discussion and a very interesting discussion with them. So I'm sorry that kept me away from the beginning of this panel, and it's a little awkward to not know what's been said. You know, I don't want to repeat too much of what's been said, but let me just maybe add a perspective on many of the things that have been said that in some cases we'll repeat, but hopefully in a way that will be educating and illuminating. So I think this whole issue of competitiveness is an awkward issue because the word is so dysfunctional, you know, and it scares people and they don't know what it means. And the typical, if you went out to a factory floor and asked a typical employee, well, what's competitiveness? You know, they probably wouldn't have much of an idea. And I think it conjures up issues of big business and of corporate profits and that have actually distracted us from what the issue is really all about. I know Jan shared our definition with you. Competitiveness is where we can create a business environment where companies based in America can actually compete successfully in international markets, while simultaneously improving the wages and standard of living for the average worker. It's those two things together that are competitiveness, not one or the other. And I think as I've been here for the last day and a half, I've started to understand that if we're going to make headway on this issue, I think one of the first things we have to do is to kind of get people to understand what competitiveness is all about. You know, competitiveness in the United States as a business location is not a problem for General Electric. They're going to do fine. They're a global company. They'll locate where they have to. They'll hire people where it's efficient and effective. If corporate taxes are silly in this country, they just won't have many of them because they won't do much in this country. They're going to do fine. The multinationals in America are generally doing well. It's not American companies, multinationals that are struggling. It's actually America as a place to do business that's struggling. You know, people with PhDs and Harvard MBAs and computer science master's degrees are going to do fine. Even if we don't deal with competitiveness problem in America, they're going to do okay. Because we'll always have a good large chunk of very high-end, sophisticated work in America because of our universities, our innovation, our science, our technology. So competitiveness is not fundamentally about American multinationals. It's not fundamentally about very highly skilled, highly educated people. Competitiveness is fundamentally about a semi-skilled worker who's middle class or lower middle class. That's where the fault line is of this issue. Those are the people that will not prosper and not advance and not have opportunity if we don't address this issue. Those are the people. And I think most of the general public doesn't understand that. They would think that competitiveness is about, you know, these other folks, but really it's really about them. The stakes of this issue are profound, because if middle-class people in America and lower middle-class people are not able to find a good well-paying job, and if they're not able to see their wages go up at a reasonable rate over time, and these are fundamental problems that I'm sure Jan has talked about, where all the data is just frightening. If we can't solve that issue, then what's going to happen? We're just going to have growing inequality. Okay? And we're already seeing what happens when you have inequality in a society and people don't feel like they have an opportunity to kind of rise up. You start to see a political system that becomes incredibly polarized, where passing pro-business, pragmatic legislation becomes almost impossible, where people get elected on a, you know, we've got to redistribute income platform. And we simply get into a downward spiral. So I think what has animated us at the school and has animated me on this issue is not to, you know, help American business be more successful internationally, but actually the profound effect on our society and everything that America has worked and stood for. And this is not an abstract, you know, geeky phrase called competitiveness. This is about real people and real incomes and real opportunity and whether the next generation will be able to go to college and all those kind of things that we have taken for granted in America. But as Janet's probably covered, you know, we're in a situation now where the trajectory of our economy is taking a path that we have not seen in at least 60 years. That we have many decades of progress. We started out with an unbeatable lead after World War II. Everybody else was devastated. We were so far ahead. We've been dynamic and innovative and entrepreneurial. And, you know, we used to have the most efficient business environment by far. We were the place where the logistics were efficient, the flexibility of labor was efficient, the regulation was pragmatic and relatively efficient. And it was those other countries were all tangled up in red tape and delay and class issues, and now it's us. So I think the stake, I just would like to reiterate how important this question is, and frankly, this is why Harvard Business School, for the first time ever, has decided to take an issue like this on as an institution. Not write a few papers, not publish a few articles, not teach a few classes, but actually take an issue on. And that's why, you know, Jan Rifkin and I are here, you know, and spending days and days and days of our time on this issue, because there's nothing more important to the future of business, and there's nothing more important to us at Harvard. So you've heard the diagnosis, it's not very controversial. You've heard, I think you talked about the 8 points. Much of that is not very controversial. It shouldn't be. A lot of it is common sense. It's not new. The fundamental question we have now is how do we get things done? What do we do to get things done? And so, and we have been here over the last couple of days and previously trying to figure that question out. At the one level, the answer is easy. We can't. It's impossible. Because of the inherent nature of the political system right now that is polarized, where we can't look for the common ground. So one can get very depressed very quickly. And as I have been shuffling back and forth from building to building and down these long corridors that I don't know which way, whether this is east or west or north or south, I've had moments of depression. Okay. But you can also start to see the beginning of something interesting happening. I've now had a chance to engage with four or five different groups of members on the House side. Virtually all of those meetings, except for the one today at lunch, were bipartisan. There's a lot of consensus about the diagnosis, a lot of consensus about what to do. So at least we've gotten to the point where we can actually have those conversations. There, you know, there's some on the tax policy side. There's I was just with Chairman Camp and his effort with the next caucus to try to move ahead on that in an interesting way. There are more and more little threads and bits and pieces of a sense that that some things could get done in some areas that we wouldn't have felt were possible a year ago or 2 years ago. I'm finding the freshman class in the Congress to be different. So far every single one I met that's a freshman is really about, you know, how can we get something done. So the sophomore class is viewed as kind of the peak of partisanship. But the freshman class, I think, has come here because of the time and the place with a different orientation. So I guess what we would love to learn from you is how would you suggest we move this ball forward? How can an institution like Harvard Business School, with its tens of thousands of alumni and its reputation and its independence, that and luckily we get to call ourselves Harvard too, because Harvard has a certain connotation that somehow crosses the aisle. We have Kennedy School graduates. What is it that could be done to see if we can accelerate this? What seems to be some promising seeds of thought that I'm experiencing going forward. We had a number of sort of proposals and ideas, about how to do that. Have you covered any of that, Jim?
No, none.
Yeah. So let me just replay some of the thoughts we heard. So one idea we had was what if we had 1,000 Harvard Business School graduates come to Washington on one day and literally descend on every member of Congress and talk about this issue? Would that matter? Would that make a difference? We've had some. So I'm not going to tell you what the reaction we've got. So that's one reaction. Could we have Harvard Business School graduates do a day with each member of Congress in their district? Engage in a variety of efforts with constituencies and various entities at the district level to talk about this issue. Could we convene some working groups on each of the eight areas? Perhaps not the budget, because that's been so heavily worked, but on the other seven areas, could we convene some working groups in which we provided our folks, our efforts, and our expertise with members from both sides of the aisle to try to craft a specific consensus proposal in each area? These are three. In the last meeting, Dan, you haven't heard this, there was a proposal that we need to get our Harvard Business School alumni talking to their employees about this issue. And spending some time helping them understand how this issue affects them and the company and their job and their ability to raise the wages over time. And because ultimately there's a disconnect between the management and the employees. The employees have not come along on this particular ride. So those are just four issues. Let me stop there and just say that we'd be interested in your reactions to, you know, which of those might matter the most, and any other thoughts you have. But I think at this point, the problem is not understanding that we're in a serious fundamental structural issue here. The problem is not the diagnosis of what our strengths and weaknesses are. I think we understand that. The problem is not even coming up with what are the, you know, most important policy areas that Washington needs to move ahead on. The problem is all about, you know, getting things done. And so we are so grateful that you've been willing to take your time and be part of this. We are committed to come back over and over if we need to, as long as we think that we can add value. But we still are in great need of advice and guidance on what would matter to move the needle. We're delighted with the partnership with ASP. I think, you know, the competitiveness as we've defined it is the mother of all issues. It's the mother of inequality. It's the mother of foreign policy. It's the mother of almost anything that we try to accomplish in our society. If we don't have a vibrant economy, if we're not creating wealth, if we're not creating jobs with higher rising wages, we can't do anything. We have no resources in our society to solve any of the problems, deal with any of the social issues that we care so much about. So this is the mother of all issues, but it's an awkward issue because it's complicated, it's multidimensional. The word competitiveness is, you know, geeky and academic sounding, and so how do we elevate the issue, and then how do we migrate progress? That's sort of my capstone of what I've learned from being here for these 2 days.
Mike, we're delighted, of course, from ASP's perspective, to have Harvard join us. Your surveys are fantastic, and I might add that the surveys, if I remember right, didn't just do the business community; you also did a public survey as a corollary to it. And there's amazing similarities between the two. And we think it's a very compelling argument when you look at those surveys, then you look at the national security perspective, and you come up here on the Hill. And some might ask, why are we up here on the Hill? Well, we're up here to influence your members of Congress, both Senate and House side, to hopefully craft legislation that will improve our competitiveness. And it's wide-ranging. There's 8 topics to yours. We had 6 sections on ours. So it's not an easy thing, and Mike mentioned, where do we go from here? We don't believe this is something we can let just have this panel today and then we're done and we'll see you next year. As you know, shelf life here in the House is pretty short, and Senate maybe a little longer, but we intend to continue to fan this flame and provide whatever assistance we can. With that, let me open up any questions or recommendations we might have from anybody here. And I see if you can please stand up, identify yourself, and hopefully keep your question fairly short. I would appreciate it.
Thank you. Rob Colorina. I'm in the private equity space. I have a chance to interface with Dr. Porter. Quick question, and then sort of a comment to one of the thoughts you had. Dr. Porter, you're involved with All World as well. All World is a network of global initiatives. So the question is, have you seen any data, have you all studied about militaries who come back from service and overseas and their propensity to get involved in either entrepreneurship, business, and the like there? That's just something that affects sort of my reaction to that.
I don't know of any data on that score.
I've not seen data. I mean, I've seen certainly impressions. We get more and more young military officers through our program. You know, we look for demonstrated leadership potential, and since, you know, 2001, young military officers have had ample opportunity to demonstrate leadership potential. And it is a remarkable generation of young leaders coming through who I think we will see have a huge impact. But in terms of real data, Rob, I've not seen anything.
Are you talking just the entire population of veterans that are returning?
Yeah, it wasn't necessarily limited to the young folks. I think some of the retirees as well, getting involved in boards, getting involved in advisory boards and the like, that affects competitiveness. Now, to the thought there that you have, Dr. Porter, on coalitions and the like, interesting idea about bringing alums to personally get involved. At the end of the day, they may be a little bit lighter on the wallet after that. But that's supposed to be a joke. But I think the sphere of coalitions could be one that you to involve other schools as well, other corporates with, you know, with sort of a win-win type interest in terms of a different approach. But I applaud what you all are doing, and it's interesting, interesting concepts.
Thank you for your comments. I think we have thought about, you thought about going to other business schools and teaming up, so that is one that is on our agenda. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Samira Daniels, and I wanted to pick up on a point that Nora Augustine brought in about education. And I think, you know, you identified this gap that has been increasing. And, you know, I just remember Robert Reich addressing the same point of this gap because of the symbolic class, basically, symbolic analysts, you know, sort of being, you know, living in a parallel universe, in a sense. Mm-hmm. And I was director of community education in Boston, in Somerville, Massachusetts, and it was a community schools program. And I think that the Harvard Business School has, you know, can really form alliances with the educational community at the high school level. I know that Project Zero was attempting to do this at the education school, but I think that, you know, it has to bring in, you know, people like with the community schools, you know, have critical thinking skills more, you know, sort of develop this critical thinking that I think is so absent now. In high school, I see it, I talk with a lot of kids, so that's my...
No, I've not mentioned this. One of the multiple efforts that has come from the Competitiveness Project has been an effort to partner with the Gates Foundation and BCG to understand how business leaders can have a more effective impact in helping educators improve, potentially transform K-12 education in America.
That's important.
You know, I believe that just adds to the bedrock. And Dunn, you've been personally involved in some thought along these lines of efforts as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it starts there. I mean, that is the raw input of a competitive economy,
yeah,
is folks that can comprehend math, science, and generally just make sense of a very, very dynamic world. So, for example, here in D.C., I mean, if you want a glimpse of what the nation is facing, I would say start here.
Yeah.
Take a right turn out of this building, keep walking, visit a few public schools, and you'll get a real sense for what's at stake. If we can't get it right within the four quadrants of the nation's capital,
yeah,
it really just highlights that. And so there are a couple of organizations here that on the HBS Clubs side, we've been working with the College Success Foundation, also sponsored by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, to increase college access for young kids in college and effectively paying for their tuition. But we have a number of groups within our country that are effectively lost generations. It's not only a question of how often do you find folks with an undergraduate degree from a decent school, it doesn't have to be Harvard Business School, where the first degree is like a high school diploma 2.0. And so that's not only a case for we're not creating sufficient high-skilled jobs in the country, it's also a case for the rest of the world is out-educating United States as well. And so starting at K-12, that's the absolute raw input that has to go into college, that has to then go into the workforce. I'm glad to see HBS has started to look into that, and your suggestions are great.
You're also seeing businesses that are stepping up to partner with schools, community colleges, to make sure that people are being trained to be the employees the employers would love to hire.
Right.
Nothing's more frustrating than to, you know, do all the hard work to get a degree and not find the job at the other end.
Yes, sir.
So Paul Rogge, I'm on my last month active duty. I'm going to go back to the real world soon.
Thank you for your service.
Absolutely.
You're welcome. One of the things that I think about a lot besides competitiveness is the need for resilience in our country. And I think there's a common root there in the approach. I'm not so much speaking to resilience, more than the common root. It's occurred to me that really, we need to look toward communities and regional dynamics to build actually both of these things. And so we tend to, in my view, overly focus on sort of what's happening on the edges, the East and West Coasts. And really, the energy, the food, the manufactured products all come from the heartland. And they all are produced by small companies that are built and manned in these small communities. And so In addition to setting the conditions that we've talked about a lot today, we might think about looking to the communities and in that sort of dynamic and see what could we do to help those communities move along, look at the councils of mayors, the governor's councils, and see how those people could be engaged, maybe elicit some ideas, and how they could even be mentored. There's a community and regional resilience institute at Oak Ridge that's going out and mentoring communities on resilience, and so maybe we could do something like that in competitiveness.
No, that's a great recommendation. I kind of deflect this to our farmer from Tennessee who's going back to the farm and working with the small communities. Any comments on that, General Castellano?
Well, one of the things, you know, we have TBA down in our area, and that's one of the big areas that they're trying to look at is how they're going to continue the electrical grid down there and distribute power and bring in wind power from Oklahoma. And,
great comment. Yes, sir.
My name is Lester Johnson. I was able to attend your other event here a few months ago, too. And first time, I was kind of stunned that Harvard is doing this, actually going in and saying, we're doing this for society. We think this is the right thing to do. I've not seen a university do that kind of thing before. I'm actually officer of the Alumni Club for the University of Chicago's Business School here in the area. So the one comment that somebody made about, you know, doing allegiances with schools, especially where you can get a dean that's going to be open-minded enough to get on, I think it just increases your scope. My
top dean into it, we'll take him on.
All right. I'm happy to do that because I was very taken with what you guys are doing. I grew up in a town pretty much the way you grew up, like in the middle of Michigan. But I've been here in D.C. now for more than 30 years, I guess. Stuff like this that I've seen take place, I believe, takes a lot of coalitions. So this coalition here of wrapping this with security now, I think is like immediately changes the meaning of this whole thing. It's not a university, it's not a great university and a bunch of university guys. Now it's also security for the country and a university. And if you can wrap some others around this without diluting it, I think that's what it's going to take. I also suggest that you're going to have to put some urgency on it and some goals for timelines on it, or it just kind of works.
Great comments. Now drop me a card with your time. We'll go after the University of Chicago. Yes, sir, all the way in the back.
I'm Ralph Schofer. I used to be in the real world a long time ago. It's a very interesting presentation. I think that the statement of Dr. Porter, that you can't do anything unless you have the wherewithal to do it, I think that's very telling and very important. I hear people talking about education. I believe in education. I've had a lot of it. I've had some at the Harvard Business School, some at Yale Graduate School of Engineering, and some at Ohio State. That's a long-term solution. That's a lag variable. You do that and you get a result way down the road. I think we really need to focus on short-term things to get a little bit of momentum going in the beginning. Maybe we have to relook at Dodd-Frank. I'm not a finance guy, but some of the big corporations are complaining that it slows them down and it's expensive. And it doesn't produce a lot. The other thing we need to look at the healthcare. There are some people in the business world that are saying, I'm not going to hire because I got to keep my rolls low because I can't afford to provide whatever is in this huge healthcare law provides. I think we got to look at short-term opportunities to get us a little bit of momentum going in the beginning.
I wouldn't argue with any of those points. I mean, today they're marking up the immigration bill. I mean, that's the hot topic of the day. We'd love to see that one improved, especially on the H-1B side of the house. Tax reform is another hot topic of the day, and I'd say it's short term. How long have we been? When's the last major tax reform, Reagan? That could be long term, but it could be short term if people got around to it. Education is forever. I mean, It's going to start at kindergarten and it's going to end in graduate. But it's something I think we all feel that it's important and we have to work with. I used to run recruiting for the Marine Corps and go to high schools. It's sad to realize that 25 to 30% of today's kids aren't even graduating from high school, couldn't even walk in the door of a recruiter today, got to have a high school diploma, just to get in the door, to get in any of the services. That's got to be fixed. I mean, that has to be fixed, but that's a great comment. I think I can take one more. Who am I not picking? Yes, sir, right here.
Hi, I'm John Jameson. I'm a political consultant. I'm also a Harvard MBA and do some work with Dante. Dr. Porter, at the beginning, you talked about the C word. It was a bad competitiveness. Let me tell you another C word that's even more of a problem here, and that's compromise. And just one example, General Cheney, when you were talking about H-1Bs or we're talking about what we want to do with STEM, I think you're proposing, if someone's got a science and technology, engineering and math degree, let's bring them. Those are great ideas. Those are great ideas. But without compromise, let's take immigration. Unless Congress and also agrees to give citizenship to folks, there is no way a bill like that is ever going to get out of the Senate. And if it did by a miracle, it would never be signed for the president. And I think what Harvard can do, and Chicago alums and the rest of them, I suspect there was some hyperbole, but I heard Boehner or Cantor met with 25 members yesterday, and every one of them reported back that not a single one of their constituents of support of the Senate bill. So whether that's true or not, I think clearly what we can do is educating. When there are town meetings back in the district, we should be educating our folks, and your point was, and it shouldn't be just the Harvard MBAs. You were right on when you were talking about employees. They should be going to town meetings, and they should be saying to members of Congress, look, I understand you're going to have to take some votes. I'm not going to agree with everything you do, but it's important that we make some sacrifices and to get this. And I'm going to support you, and I'm going to contribute and work. I think we're educating our people out there. So these, whether so Republican members in tough districts or who are worried about getting primaried, so they can understand there is a support in their district for compromise and all that. I think if that's a part of what we're doing, that can make a difference, because as long as these guys are convinced that if they vote for something like this and they're going to lose, we're not going to get them.
You couldn't be more correct. And we're well aware of that issue. We're trying to talk both sides of the aisle here.
Yeah.
Certainly the far right, if we can get in the door, say here's where, and that's the national security side of this house, and say, yeah, pitch it to your constituents that you're going to impact their lives, certainly the national security, and we can prove that point. I would encourage everybody to go on our website, AmericanSecurityProject.org. We are recording this today. It'll be uploaded here this afternoon or late this evening. We talked competitiveness quite a bit there. We had our report put out last year. That's on there as well. The two surveys that Harvard's done have been fabulous. And we're not going to let this dialogue die out. Your comments today were spot on. I really appreciate you coming today. And if you've got a member or a staffer that you want us to come talk to, contact us at American Security Project or Harvard Business School. We're right here down on New York Avenue, so it's just a metro ride up for us, so it's not hard to do. But again, I appreciate everybody coming. Thank you very much.